This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Hawaii has a goal of generating 100% of our electricity needs from renewable sources by 2045. But our most abundant renewable resource, solar, varies seasonally and throughout the day. To counter that unpredictability, Hawaii's utilities plan to use batteries to store excess power for when it's not being generated. But a source of power that is reliable 24/7 will still be needed. Researchers at the University of Hawaii think that geothermal could be part of the solution. Ted Brennis is a graduate student working at the Hawaii Groundwater and Geothermal Resource Center. He recently presented research exploring the cost effectiveness of geothermal in Hawaii compared to other renewable sources and spoke about it with HPR's Ryan Finnerty.
Currently, the state is not getting any geothermal energy. The state's one functioning geothermal plant stopped operating in May 2018. It was the Puna Geothermal Venture, PGV. They stopped operating because of the Leilani Estates eruption. Prior to that, PGV was providing about a quarter of the Big Island's energy needs. The Hawaiian Electric Power Supply Improvement Plan is the Hawaiian Electric's plan to get the state to 100% renewables by 2045. There's several versions in that plan, but the most of the versions call for a pretty modest amount of geothermal. Most versions have about 80 megawatts of a geothermal energy being installed between now and 2045.
What does 80 megawatts work out to in terms of total percentage?
So right now, I think the state uses about 2,000 megawatts. Like, that's what we need to generate to kind of keep all the lights on. It's probably a little bit more than that. So 80 megawatts is a pretty small chunk. Like I said, prior to PGV shutting down, it was providing a quarter of the Big Island's energy needs, which is, that's pretty significant. What's interesting is that we don't really know how much geothermal energy potential there is in the state. There's been some studies. One study done by Geothermics in 2000 estimate that there could be as much as 1,500 megawatts of geothermal potential across the state. So it's just largely on characters. We don't really know across the other islands how much there could be.
1,500, so that's 75% of the estimated 2,000 total that the state's using. So that's pretty significant.
Yeah, potentially that could, that 1,500 could meet, at least now, three quarters of the state's energy demands.
And so where is the rest of it coming from, especially if we're going to be relying heavily on solar, which everybody kind of knows only works at certain times of the day? It kind of fluctuates in terms of output based on the cloud cover and the time of day and everything. What's the rest of that plan look like?
Yeah, so I mean, baseload energy is one of the biggest issues with renewables. Solar resources and wind resources can't provide baseload energy at some point through the day, or because the seasoned wind and solar resources don't generate any electricity. So the answer to that, at least in large part in the power supply improvement plan, is battery storage. So there's something like 3,000 megawatts of battery storage planned for the state over the next 25 years, which is a ton. That's a lot of battery storage. And that's how I think HECO is planning to answer that baseload energy problem. How do we feed people? How do we give people energy that they need, the energy that they need when they need it, when we're using resources that aren't working all the time?
And that's kind of how you began looking at geothermal and comparing the output and the cost and everything of geothermal energy versus wind and solar and some of these more widely used renewable sources. And what did you find?
Yeah, the geothermal, when it stacks up against other renewables, it's pretty competitive. I mean, geothermal power plants have really low land use. Puna Geothermal Venture sits on about 45 acres and has an installed capacity of 38 megawatts. So that comes out to a little over an acre per megawatt, which is really good. Solar resources generally occupy 5 to 10 acres per installed megawatt. Wind resources they fluctuate between 30 and 100 some acres per megawatt. So as far as land use goes, geothermal is really, really good. And when it comes to providing baseload energy, like I said, wind and solar resources can't provide baseload, but geothermal in the state does provide baseload energy. We can turn it on or turn it off whenever we need it to provide energy as folks need to use it.
Is there any way in which geothermal is not competitive compared to wind and solar, either in terms of developing the resource or actually installing the infrastructure?
Yeah, all the renewables and every resource in general, there's hazards and drawbacks to them. Geothermal is not without its drawbacks and hazards. One of the biggest concerns is blowouts. Blowouts are uncontrolled, unplanned venting of hydrothermal fluids in the atmosphere. The big concern with blowouts is the release of hydrogen sulfide, which quickly gets converted into sulfur dioxide and can cause acid rain. And hydrogen sulfide is toxic above certain levels, so, and it smells like rotten eggs, so it's unpleasant. So that's a concern, and there have been blowouts in PGV's history. There are rare occurrences, but they do happen. Drilling is also an invasive, expensive thing to do, and you need to do that to develop a geothermal resource, so that can be a problem. Geothermal resources can be noisy. PGV has had some issues with noise complaints in the past, so that's a problem as well. But again, no renewable energy resource is perfect. Solar resources, they require a lot of raw materials. You need to mine very high-grade quartz to get purified silicon to make solar wafers, and that's an energy-intensive, chemically-intensive process. You got to pit mine usually to get quartz to mine or to create solar panels. Wind resources require a ton of cement. I think each 2-megawatt wind turbine requires something like 700 tons of concrete, and concrete releases CO2, so there's a carbon footprint associated with wind resources as well. So no resource is perfect, but overall I think my research at least has shown that geothermal is competitive, and I think it's a good option that needs to be explored further in Hawaii.
How does it compare in terms of cost? So the electricity produced by a geothermal plant versus electricity produced by a solar farm or a wind farm. How does it break down in terms of expense?
That's a tough question to answer. So it varies by power plant. Like they negotiate, like a power plant, when HECO agrees to buy power from a power facility, they negotiate on what that rate's going to be, so it changes. Overall, in terms of like capital costs for making power plants, the Power Supply Improvement Plan has some really good cost projections that were prepared by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory. These cost estimates are pretty reliable. They're localized. They're for Hawaii. And when you look at those numbers, they actually show that geothermal is competitive in terms of cost as well, particularly when you look at the necessity of battery storage, like wind and solar resources, to have the same capabilities as a geothermal resource, like that to provide baseload energy, they need battery storage. And that's, like I said, the Power Supply Improvement Plan has a ton of battery storage in there. So when you look at that, when you look at the necessity of battery storage, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory and HECO both show that geothermal has pretty competitive costs, so it can be affordable as well.
So geothermal has lower land requirement, and it can be more productive in terms of electricity on that smaller land requirement, but it needs to be located in an area that has this geothermal resource. And you mentioned earlier there's only one plant in the state in Puna. So is it realistic for planning purposes to think that we could have geothermal energy production in other parts of Hawaii?
I think so, yeah. I mean, the bottom line is that we don't really know. It's not well characterized. We've explored Kilauea East Rift Zone pretty thoroughly, and we know that there are viable resources in Kilauea East Rift Zone. Across the rest of Hawaii Island and across Maui, we think there's some geothermal potential as well, but we don't know exactly what that is. And I think that's the key. We need to better characterize the potential across the rest of the state so we can plan effectively.
And your paper points out another interesting little quirk, that the solar industry actually receives public subsidies, so it gets tax credits. Geothermal, at least in Hawaii, actually pays taxes to the state. It's taxed for extracting the resource.
Yeah, the solar industry in particular has been heavily subsidized. The biggest subsidy has come from the Hawaii Renewable Energy Technology Income Tax Credit. At least that's the biggest one that I could find. And between 2011 and 2016, something like $670 million in tax credits were claimed by Hawaii residents through that tax credit. In contrast to that, the Puna Geothermal Venture has been paying royalties to the state because geothermal resources are considered mineral resource, and they have to pay royalties. So over the course, I think from 2007 to 2018, PGV has paid the state a little over $24 million in royalties. So solar has cost taxpayers money, you know, it's been subsidized, and in contrast, geothermal has been a source of revenue for the state.
And so at the end of the day, we're shooting to make this 2045 goal of 100% renewable energy. What do you think the role of geothermal should be in that portfolio?
I think we need to maximize every available resource we have. And that's a tough question to answer. I mean, we got to figure out how much potential there is. I mean, the bottom line is that we live very energy intensive lives. Every time we get in the car to go to the grocery store when we could walk, or every time we fly to the mainland to visit our family or have another kid, we are guzzling energy. And unless we want to dramatically change our lifestyles, we're going to need to take advantage of every resource we can get. And I think geothermal has great potential to provide baseload energy to the state, and we can't afford to not explore that thoroughly.
All right, Ted Brennis, thanks for your time today.
Thanks. Good talking with you.
Ted Brennis is a graduate student working with the Hawaii Groundwater and Geothermal Resource Center. We'll have a link to his research exploring the cost effectiveness of geothermal energy in Hawaii and a fact sheet on renewable energy from the State Energy Office posted on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
This week on This American Life, Shmilo was 12 when she was taken captive by members of her own family that kept her for years. And her one refuge was this book, the only book she had that she kept in secret. It was the novel Little Women. Written in 1868, it seemed to have all kinds of parallels and lessons for her exact situation, where she was being told to be a certain kind of girl. That's this week.
Saturday afternoon at 1.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Today's quiz concerns the strategic location in our backyard for a lighthouse and the surprising amount of time and the effort it took to get it built. For years before our mystery lighthouse was constructed, sailors and landlubbers alike knew that one was needed because of its geographic location. Now, the late 19th century brought increased commercial maritime traffic to the Kingdom of Hawaii, and sea captains wanted a little help out there. A petition was circulated in 1888, and Lauren Thurston, Interior Minister for the Kingdom, got in touch with European lens crafters for an appropriate reflector in 1890. But it wasn't until 1906, after annexation, that the U.S. House of Representatives appropriated the necessary funds. So the question, what's the name of this lighthouse, and what is so important about its location? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you think you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Waimea Valley's Summer Concert Series, presenting Brada Walta, Darren Benitez, and more, 3 to 6:30 p.m., Saturday, July 27th. Tickets at waimeavalley.net.
This week on Says You.
I always love the fact, too, that hot dogs were invented about 30 years before the bun. Yeah. And I just had this vision of, for 30 years, people looking at the mustard going down their arm. We got to do something about this, you know.
That's why you have like 8 buns and 6 hot dogs.
Yeah, that's right.
A game as fast as it's fun, and everyone's a winner, says you.
This evening at 6:30, right after Marketplace.
Cutting-edge medical technology has arrived in Hawaii. It's a new imaging tool called a PET-CT digital scanner. It's so advanced, only 24 machines are in place on the mainland. Hawaii makes 25th in the nation and only 67th in the whole world. Radiologist Dr. Lynn Marinai and Max Clinney, president of Insight Imaging, joined us in the studio to talk about what this means for early detection of cancer and treatment for Hawaii patients.
We're really excited. This is a project that we have been looking at for a couple of years. The technology was unveiled fairly recent, and this truly is the next step in the evolution of PET-CT as sort of the gold standard diagnostic tool to diagnose cancer primarily. There are other applications which we're excited about, and it's a bit at a novel stage now, so not used as standard of care. But in the world of cancer diagnosis, this really is the next step in the evolution. And it took some time to figure out how to fund the project and how to get it to the islands, but as of a couple of weeks ago, we're very excited to be able to offer this innovative technology to our community.
So this was a $3 million investment, but we're one of only really a small number of places in the world that has this type of technology.
That's correct. It's so innovative that we are officially the 25th install in the United States. Obviously, the first and only one in Hawaii. And globally, we were the number 67th install. So we are certainly early adapters. And again, the cause for a lot of excitement is to be able to bring something that is truly cutting edge to our community. And that's always been sort of our goal to move and propel this world of imaging forward.
And Doctor, talk about what you've seen in the images, how different it is.
When you compare the current technology, which is an all-digital state, to the prior analog PET-CT, the detail in looking at smaller lesions, and here we're talking about cancer, the image quality, it's clearer. It's very similar to how you used to watch television, 20 years ago, and the current digital televisions you see with the increase in definition, sharpness, contrast, brightness. These are the images that you can see with the current PET-CT scanner. It's called Verios. And we leverage that technology to help the cancer patients. So the patients that come to Insight Imaging, it's for diagnosis. It's for staging, that is, determining how much of a disease burden they have. It's used for treatment response, and to a certain extent, it also gives you some information about prognosis. So the machine is quite exquisite. The images are very good. They're excellent. And personally, as a physician, it's just such a great privilege to be able to have this technology in front of you, particularly when you compare it to older cameras.
And so you've just opened up your doors. You've had a handful of patients come through, including, I think, someone from the neighbor islands.
Yes, we during the first week, we ramped up. We had 50 patients. We were just trying to get used to the new images. There is a bit of a learning curve because you're beginning to see so much precise detail, and you want to be careful in calling a lesion cancer. You don't want to overcall it. So you have so much more information, and we're just careful of what we want to get out of the camera? Do we, how fast do we want to go? How much dose do we want to decrease? We're talking about radiation dose. Certainly, if you want to get the, our top priority is getting the best images on our patients, because again, we want to detect the smallest lesion with the greatest diagnostic accuracy and the highest confidence. And so there's many ways we can try to use the technology, but at the same time, we do want to get the best for the patient. And again, it's the three things we're looking at. We would like to get image detail, quality imaging. We'd like to go fast because the patients want fast scans. And we'd like to have patient safety by decreasing the radiation dose. So using those three, we'd like to somehow find the sweet spot. And we haven't done that yet because we've just been with the camera for what must be a couple weeks now. And I think as we move forward, certainly our referring physicians, our medical oncologists, pulmonologists, radiation oncologists, we'll have to let them know this is we're trying to use this new technology, trying to determine what's the best we can offer. And because what they're interested in is they want to get as close to the truth as possible. And we're hoping that this PET CT scanner, with its all digital capability, will help us get that much closer to the truth.
And so talk about who this equipment will be available for. Insurance will cover it?
That's an excellent point, and an important one to make for the audience, that while we've made a big investment because we truly believe that this will benefit our community, and those afflicted with cancer. The good news is for those patients and our overall healthcare system is that the reimbursement from the insurance company has not changed one bit. Hence, the amount that the insurance companies and a patient copay would have that they were paying a couple months ago will remain the same, even though the opportunity to now have a better scan is available to them.
What about the idea that it might be available for patients that come from abroad?
Right. And as far as being able to service our community and even those coming from other places, we're sort of agnostic to that. So we are happy to provide the service to anyone who is referred to us by a physician, and regardless of their ability to pay and their domicile, we will be happy to service their needs.
So, like, where is the next closest machine?
The next closest machine is probably in California. There's a few centers, as I mentioned earlier. There's 24 other centers around the country. There's a few on the West Coast. UCSF, as an example. They actually have two. They were install number 24 right before us, but they were also one of the very first installs in the country at their research lab. So they have one fully dedicated for research purposes, and the second one that they installed is fully dedicated for patients.
What about in Asia? Do they have one in Japan?
I do believe that there's a few in Asia. I can't remember offhand which country. I remember just seeing the global map, and I know there was a few there. But the prevalence was in Europe and the U.S. initially.
There's one thought. Certainly, if you can detect the disease earlier, your prognosis is better and you have a higher chance for cure. I think the PET CT, we have to remember its place in the armamentarium of diagnostic imaging. So diagnostic imaging is non-invasive. For instance, if there's a nodule in your lung and you want to know whether that's cancerous or not, there's certain ways to monitor it, with a chest X-ray, with a CT scan, and you can, if it looks worrisome to the pulmonologist or the medical oncologist or your primary care physician, you could certainly have a surgeon go in and remove it, or you could have the radiologist put a needle into it with CT guidance. So if there's a suspicious nodule, and short of doing something invasive, you may elect to do something non-invasive, but is fairly accurate in the diagnosis. So hence, you could label a simple sugar molecule with a radioactive tracer like fluorine 18, fluorodeoxyglucose, inject it into the patient's vein. It will circulate, and if the nodule is avid, takes up this particular tracer with higher concentration, then it becomes very suggestive that it may be a malignancy, and then that will help you towards the next step of whether you would like to put a needle into it or whether, if it's very worrisome, whether a surgeon should go in after it. So that's the first part. The second part is, let's say you have the nodule and you do the PET CT scan, you may save a needless surgery if there's been spread, significant spread, either to the mediastinum or outside to the liver, to your bones. Then that gives you information about not just your prognosis, but that you're not a surgical candidate, that perhaps chemotherapy or some other radiotherapy may be the choice of treatment. And so that's where the PET CT scan, and again with the fluorodeoxyglucose label, becomes an important part of the whole armamentarium of diagnostic imaging.
And can you talk about the training that's involved in, you know, using this type of equipment since it's new? I don't know, you've had to dispatch your staff elsewhere to understand what's involved.
Absolutely. The training was fairly intensive and comprehensive. It included sending folks to the headquarters for Philips USA, which is in Cleveland, Ohio, as well as bringing one of their trainers out to our site and spend about 2 weeks with our crew here locally to make sure that the information was retained and applied correctly. So the ongoing efforts will continue as we move forward. We will have an additional training session in about a month as a follow-up to the initial one, and there's a whole rigorous schedule that follows that. So the support from the vendor has been tremendous. And because, again, as Dr. Mott and I touched on, the technology is so exciting, but at the same time, it is so avant-garde, we are also learning along the way, and it's important for our staff to be fully trained on its capabilities so that eventually Dr. Mott and I and his colleagues can take that information and interpret it as correctly as they possibly can.
And is this equipment, let's say, something that might be available to the military community?
Typically, we are able to service the military community via their insurance carrier. So it's certainly something that is available to them. Tripler Hospital, as an example, has a similar piece of equipment from the, as we like to refer to, the analog times, similar to what we used to have. And so if they wanted to try the difference and see what the image quality looks like, and again, some of the patient comfort benefits that Dr. Mott and I touched on, as an example, a typical analog scanner, which is what is available in all the other sites, would take anywhere between 30 to 45 minutes for an average scan versus a scan time of 5 to 10 minutes. So the change in that experience is significant. The reduction in scan time also allows for the patient to remain still, which is an important component of the procedure. And it's much easier, as you can imagine, to be lying flat for 5 to 10 minutes and be still versus 45 minutes.
Right. And then what's been the experience at other places where you have this equipment on the mainland? Are there long wait lists now?
As a matter of fact, about a month or so ago, Dr. Madanai and I went to meet with the vendor during one of the big national conferences. And there is a bit of a backlog of orders for this machine. So we are fortunate that we were able to sort of leapfrog some of these orders and get it installed in Hawaii pretty quickly. They do expect to have, I believe it was 25 more installs just in the next 6 months.
That was Inside Imaging President Max Clinney and radiologist Dr. Lynn Marinai talking about the new installation of Hawaii's first fully digital PET CT imaging system. A troubling child abuse story involving a military couple and their two infants. That's our reality check today with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Investigations editor John Hill joins us this morning. Hi, John.
Good morning.
You know, I read your story and I was shocked. It made me sad and then it made me mad that our system didn't catch this. Share with listeners the details about this this really tragic
Certainly.
Story.
Yes, it started in 2016 when the couple, Natasha Beyer and Caleb Humphrey, brought their infant son, Grayson, into the emergency room at Tripler, and he was limp and unresponsive, and they started doing tests on Grayson and determined that he was having basically bleeding in the brain, and they concluded ultimately that he had suffered a herpes simplex virus infection that had caused the brain bleeding, but there were some other troubling signs that did not go into that analysis. For instance, he had four broken ribs, and he also suffered retinal bleeding, which is a classic sign of child abuse.
That was shocking to me. That those signs just went, you know, unnoticed.
Yeah, and some of this is hard to decipher exactly who knew what when, but in Hawaii, you are required by law, if you are a doctor or medical professional or any number of other professionals, teachers, for instance, to report any suspected child abuse. You don't have to prove that it happened. You just have to suspect that it might have happened. And in this case, that apparently did not happen. And then there was a further analysis of this case, unfortunately, a little bit more than a year after Grayson had died, that the same couple showed up at Tripler with another newborn, this one 9 days old, Aveline, a daughter. And it became apparent right away that she had suffered horrible abuse. She had very much some of the same symptoms. She had brain bleeding, but also some other very clear signs of abuse. So at that point, they went back and looked at the earlier death of Grayson and determined ultimately that that also had been a homicide, blunt force trauma. Honolulu's medical examiner, Christopher Happy, and also an Air Force investigator, military investigator, determined that that earlier death of Grayson had also been because of abuse.
Now, I know Tripler also works as like a training hospital. Any indication that that might have come into play in the reporting or the diagnosis?
You know, Tripler wouldn't answer any of my questions because they say that the military couple, the Air Force couple, are facing criminal charges and they can't comment on a case that they don't want to jeopardize that criminal case by saying anything out of court that they shouldn't. So they didn't really address that. I mean, one of the questions I asked them was, do your doctors and other medical professionals get training in the mandated reporting law? And that was one of the questions that they did not answer. Every state has mandated reporting laws that require medical professionals, doctors, et cetera, to report suspected abuse. Hawaii has a law. It's different in some respects than other states. But that was one of my questions. I didn't get an answer.
I mean, this case is just, like I said, shocking because the children are so young, so vulnerable, weeks old and days old.
It's true, and that makes it, I think, hard to determine what happened. And if an older child has been abused, they might be able to say something, or there's something in their behavior may indicate it. With an infant, that's harder to tell. Also, infants are prone to a lot of, medical perils early in life. And so it was another thing that was pointed out to me is, and is also, I think, known in the literature, is that if a couple doesn't, if parents don't have any history of abuse, it can be kind of hard to imagine that these people have abused their child like this. It's a, something we don't like to think about people. And in this case, though, there were some pretty clear signs, and people who reviewed it afterwards really did think that they should have taken a much closer look at whether abuse had occurred here.
And because this involved a military installation, was it harder to get access to records?
It's hard to get access to records regarding any child abuse case. A lot of it is kept under wraps. There are very limited circumstances in which government agencies report anything about a child abuse case, even that a child is in the system or his parents are in the system. And I think the fact that it was also the military adds another layer of difficulty in determining what happened, even just finding the court records and the charges against the parents was much more challenging than if it had been civilians.
And you mentioned that the child is now on the mainland?
Yes. The second child, as I understand, is in foster care on the mainland. And I don't know anything about her medical condition. She has a court-appointed advocate who thinks she may require lifetime medical care from her injuries. And he went to court to try to preserve her right to bring a lawsuit if that were the case.
Yeah, well, very sobering story. Thank you, John.
Thank you for having me.
That was Sybil Beat Investigations Editor John Hill with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit sybilbeat.org.
Hi, it's Matt Cattingoo, former principal pops conductor of the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on the HPR mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
Today on the Backyard Quiz, we asked you about a lighthouse that mariners spent years working to get built and why its location was so important. Well, the location was and remains the southeasternmost point on Oahu. The lighthouse, as you likely figured out by now, was built on Makapu Point. The lens was something special, a so-called hyper-radiant Fresnel lens, the largest made up to that time, and that had been originally displayed as one of the wonders of the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. That lens was 12 feet tall with over 1,000 prisms, and throughout the 20th century, it remained the largest at any U.S. lighthouse. The land was turned over to the state in 1987, and today the spectacular view from Makapu Point makes it a popular hiker's destination. Congratulations to Donald Carrera Ching from Kahalu. You got it right. That's today's quiz. If you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Save the forest, save our birds. That's the slogan of the Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project. And in our Hawaii Garden and Forest segment, we head over to the Valley Isle. Imagine attaching transmitters on Maui's endangered birds. That's challenging enough, but try moving a whole population of the rare Maui parrotbill, a type of Hawaiian honeycreeper, to another part of the island. We talked to Hannah Mounts, the coordinator of the project, who is planning to do just that.
Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project is trying to basically prevent the extinction of forest birds on Maui. So we work on recovering the kiwi-kiu, which is the most endangered forest bird on Maui, and we have been putting radio transmitters out on Hawaii Amakihi to be able to track them around the forest. And it's kind of a trial for when we're going to put the more endangered bird out in that same forest habitat and be able to track them as well.
So how do you actually put these transmitters on the birds? Explain that process.
Yeah, they're very tiny. They have to weigh less than 3 to 5% of the bird's weight. So they're very, very tiny, and they go around their legs with an elastic loop harness, and they sit in the middle of their back, and the birds basically can't take them off. And then we follow them around with handheld antennas, and, you know, we get different locations on where they are and then try to get a visual on the actual bird.
That's amazing. I mean, how long have we been doing this?
Oh, the technology gets better every single year. I work on very small dinky birds, so we had to wait a long time until these transmitters could get small enough that we could put them on small birds. You know, bigger animals, we've been able to, you know, you can do really fancy stuff like satellite tracking and things like that, but we can't put something that big on these small birds, so we have to rely on just being able to track them on land.
Now, I recall doing a story with the shark tagging. And Carl Meyer out at Coconut Island and his staff, they actually put satellite tags on big tiger sharks, very big tiger sharks. But same thing, they talked about how the technology has gotten better and better. And they actually have a critter cam on a shark. But I imagine with the bird, it's a little different because, like you said, they're so tiny.
They're so tiny. I mean, these birds, the kiwi-kiw, when we put the transmitters on them, kiwi-kiw weigh between 17 to 25 grams. I mean, these guys are tiny. And so you can't put something very big on them. And so as the technology improves, though, basically it's the battery that weighs a lot. And so as it improves, you're able to get a longer duration. So like some people have put transmitters on dragonflies. So, I mean, they're super tiny, but they don't last very long. These transmitters that we're putting on now with current technology, we're going to be able to get them to last about 25 to 60 days, depending on the bird's weight, which is actually a pretty long time to be able to follow them around.
And describe this bird for our listeners who aren't familiar with it.
Sure. So kiwi-kiw, it's kind of like the woodpecker role on Maui. So they have a really big curved bill, and they rip apart bark and branches and things like that to find invertebrates and grubs that are inside. It's a yellow-green bird, and some people look at it, it's a little bit smaller than a lovebird, and with that same like giant bill. So it's very unique, and there aren't any other honeycreepers like it.
Okay, so there's a very small population on Maui.
There is a very small population on Maui, so our project is focused on that species because they're the most critically endangered on Maui. The current population estimates less than 300 individuals, and that's a global population because they're a Maui endemic.
And so is it a particular area of Maui where they're found?
They're currently found on the windward slopes of Maui, everywhere from people have often visited TNC's Waikamoi Preserve, which is a windward rainforest area that people can access. And they're found there all the way across that windward slope above 5,000 feet. But very remote, very few people experience them. But we're actually moving them to the leeward side of the island this October, which is really exciting because they're isolated up there on that windward slope because that's the only good forest we have left on Maui. And they probably don't really want to be there. When you look at the fossil record, they were found island-wide, but we just don't have forest and disease-free habitat for them island-wide anymore. So they're just restricted to this little 36 square kilometer area. So we're going to move them. We've been doing forest restoration. We're going to move them to the leeward side. We're going to support them and hope that we can establish a second population on the other side of the volcano.
That's pretty exciting stuff, though, when you try and translocate a group of birds.
Yeah, super exciting, super scary. We're putting very little tiny endangered birds in boxes and flying them via helicopters from one side of the mountain to the other, letting them go in a koa forest instead of an ohia forest. But we're losing them on the windward side. Their population is continuing to decline, and they're in protected habitat. It's already fenced. You know, the ungulates are out, and until we get landscape level management for introduced small mammals or disease control, which would be mosquito management, there's nothing else we can do for them on that side. So we've got the opportunity to give them another chance on the other side.
And ungulates, we're talking pigs.
Pigs, deer, goats, yep.
Okay. So, gosh, so hopefully they'll adapt to this other home that they'll be moved to.
Yeah, we hope so. Historically, they were found in this area that we're moving them to. But of course, that individual bird that we're going to move has never been in that habitat before. So we're constructing aviaries that we're going to put the birds in for 1 to 2 weeks. They're going to learn how to eat out of feeders that we provide live food for them and get them familiar with that area. And then we do what we call a soft release, whereas after they've been in the aviary for 1 or 2 weeks, then we open the doors. And then we're going to be able to track them with those transmitters to see how they're interacting with the environment.
And if these transmitters only last for a certain time, then how do you recover the birds and then reband them?
Right. So when we let them go with the transmitters on, we also put a set of color bands on their legs. And so these are plastic bands that have a unique combination. So on one bird's leg, his right leg might have a red and a black, and his other leg might have a yellow over his metal band, which has a number on it. So you're actually able to identify that individual through binoculars for the rest of his life. But it's obviously a lot harder to find them when the transmitter battery dies and you don't have any clues to tell you where they are.
And is there a way that the transmitters, like, fall off?
There are, yeah, because we don't want them on the birds the rest of their life because they're obviously impacting them. So when we make that loop harness that we talked about, we put a little weak link, we call it, with a little piece of rubber band. And we sew this little piece of rubber band in there, and that rubber band deteriorates with UV damage and just being, you know, wet and dry and wet and dry. And then that breaks, and then the transmitter falls off.
And then do we have any capability to do a critter cam at all?
Too small, way too small. It'd be so cool, though, to be able to see them, like, foraging and digging through bark and things like that. But, yeah, no, these transmitters are so tiny. What we can do is we can put game cameras up on the feeding stations. And so when the bird actually comes back to the feeding station, we can then take photos of who's coming back and look at what they're doing.
Okay. And then what about the threats to these birds?
Right. So the threats to these birds are very similar to all the forest birds across Hawaii. We've lost most of our forest on all the islands, and so forest loss and continued degradation is big. But even in the forest areas that are left, our current threats that we're facing are the constant influx of new introduced plants and animals, so invasive species, and then the invasive species that are here, like mammalian predators that are predating on these birds. And then we also have the unique challenge of avian disease. So we have introduced mosquitoes and introduced disease, and that limits almost all of our native forest birds to high elevation areas, which makes recovery a little bit more challenging.
Yeah, because I imagine you have a long way to go to get to work.
We do. Luckily, we have helicopters in Hawaii.
And then I guess what makes you so passionate about this type of work with these birds?
Yeah, it's great. I actually came to Hawaii as an intern on this same project 13 years ago. And one thing that's great about Hawaii is the islands are so small that we really can make a difference. So, you know, Maui is being very progressive with fencing, and we have lots of really strong partnerships and moving forward with forest restoration that we can really see, like, a bright future for these guys going forward.
And is there any bright spot on the horizon for funding to be able to continue doing what you're doing, or at least ramp it up in some way?
Yeah, funding is always an issue, and people always ask how they can help, and I always hate saying, like, well, funding, but it is a big thing where, you know, we want people who live here to have ownership over, you know, the land and the island and be able to, you know, to give back. And something that's been really great for us is we've been basically a forest restoration project the last few years while we've been getting this reintroduction site ready, and it's working. So people see that, and they actually see this forest that's being rebuilt as a hope spot. And that has been, you know, able to get us additional funding where people want to sponsor trees and they want to volunteer and things like that. We're a nonprofit, so we have a very diverse funding stream from both state, federal, private, and nonprofit funding.
And I know we had some scientists in here who were working with endangered snails, and I think we had Lonesome George. You know, they had names for all their snails. You have names for your birds too?
Sometimes we try not to name them, but it's funny, their color band combos kind of lend themselves to names, and so sometimes when people are in the field, they do give the different pairs just like names, like the Chico's pair or the Cubs or something like that, because they know based on their colors who they're talking about.
A Okay. All right. So we're rooting for the team. Right?
Yeah.
And you have to come back and let us know how the move goes in the fall.
We would love to. Yeah. It's a really exciting next few months. This has been 13 years coming. And moving these first birds in the fall is going to tell us a lot, and we're going to really know how they're going to react to that landscape. We're going to know how we're going to forward in the future. So it's going to be a busy few months, and yeah, we'd love people to keep in touch with the project and follow us online, and we'll try to post lots of updates and keep people in the loop of what's going on.
And that was Hannah Mounts, the coordinator of the Maui Forest Bird Recovery Project. The ambitious QEQ project was spotlighted at the Hawaii Conservation Conference, which was held earlier this month on Oahu.
Gypsy 808 will transport you across continents and through time with sounds inspired by Django Reinhardt and the 1930s Gypsy jazz scene in a toe-tapping, finger-snapping performance. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Amoresco.
Should I get a blender or a food processor?
I really don't want to go to the gym.
What should we watch?
Should I take anthropology or sociology?
Why is it so hard for us to make decisions?
Should I ask him to dance?
Should I break up with him?
And once we make them, to move on. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
This evening at 7, right after Says You.
That is it for today. Up tomorrow, we plan to look back at a first for the Conservation Conference, and it involved the Hawaiian language, Olelo Hawaii. Tell us what's on your mind, call our talkback line, and leave your comments. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We are on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of this show or want to find a past one, just find them on the Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Look under HPR News and Talk for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the Conversation.